Chapter 4 is entitled Transcendental Knowledge. So mainly this fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita is focusing on Karma Yoga philosophically, but in this chapter the added difference is that real stress is placed on the fact that one's karma yoga must be performed for the pleasure of Krishna. This is stressed particularly in the first section of this chapter. Krishna establishes his own position very clearly, something that he hasn't done so far at all, at least not very much at all. So now, in the fourth chapter, the transcendental knowledge actually which this chapter is named for is mainly this knowledge about Krishna. Earlier on in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna made the point that many, many births both you and I have passed. I can remember all of them, but you can't. So in this way, Krishna made a distinction between himself and Arjuna and the rest of us, that he's in a different category. He also, towards the end of the second chapter, when he was describing Buddhi Yoga, Nishkam Karma Yoga, there was one verse in which he said, Mat Paraha, that you must perform this Karma Yoga with attachment to me. And in the third chapter, he also, the same point was there, just briefly referred to, like Yajyatat Karma Non Yatra, that you must perform Yajna or Karma Yoga for Vishnu, who is, of course, a form of Krishna. But now here in the fourth chapter, Krishna is very explicitly going to establish himself as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, from whom everything has come, and that he is the real goal of all of our activities, including these activities of Karma Yoga. This theme of Karma Yoga is the main theme in these first six chapters, as we discussed on the first day. Yoga, different types of yoga, but particularly Karma Yoga. So again, in the fourth chapter, Karma Yoga is also being discussed, but now very, very specifically in relationship with Krishna himself. So our first section, section A, transcendental knowledge about Krishna. So there are four subsections. In the first, Krishna discusses the principle of parampara. In the first verse, Krishna explains how previously he established a parampara. Imam vivasvate yogam proktavam aham avyayam vivasvan manave praha manurikshvakave pranit. Previously he established another parampara beginning with vivasvan, but in the second verse he explains that even though that parampara worked for some time, the knowledge was handed down from saintly king to saintly king through the generations, but unfortunately that succession was broken. That in itself is an interesting story. Briefly, what happened was that one great sage, Gotama, probably you've heard of Gotama Rishi, there was a major disturbance in the universe, and all the Brahmins in the universe, they came to the ashram of Gotama to take shelter from this. I'm not sure what exactly happened, but they were all very disturbed, so they came and took shelter of Gotama, and they stayed in his ashram. Then, when the disturbance was over, and Gotama wanted them to all No, Gotama wanted them all to stay. He wouldn't let them go home. And they wanted to go home. So they made up a trick so as they could get release from Gotama's ashram and be able to go back home. So that trick was, they made up one calf out of straw, and they put this straw calf on the pathway leading down to the river from the ashram. During the course of one night, they left it there. So Gotama, when he went down to take his bath the next morning, he was walking down the path and he knocked over the straw calf. So all these Brahmins came down afterwards and they said, "Oh, you just killed a cow. So we can't stay here any longer. We're going." So they all left. They had to make up this trick, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to get away. So they all went. So Gotama, he was really disturbed that I killed a cow. How is this possible? So he went looking around, where's this cow that I killed? And then he found the straw calf, and he realized that it was just a trick. So he cursed all the Brahmins, this is all the Brahmins in the universe, that you'll lose all your knowledge. May your knowledge become ignorance. So this is actually how the parampara was broken. And this is why Vyas came, and this is also an important reason why Krishna himself came. Particularly Vyas came to re-establish the Vedas from this position of basically being lost. And Bhagavad Gita was also lost along with the Vedas. So Krishna himself here is re-establishing Bhagavad Gita. Anyway, that parampara, starting with Vivasvan, was broken. Srila Prabhupada gives a calculation in the purport of the first verse. It's rather a complicated calculation. But the idea is that he gave this, the demigods, all the demigods in the universe change every manu. There are 14 manus in one day of Brahma. So other than Brahma, Vishnu and Shiva, all the demigods are replaced each manu. In other words, 14 times in a day of Brahma. So Prabhupada is basing his calculation, it's on page 217 in this, my Bhagavad Gita. He's basing his calculation on the assumption that Krishna spoke this knowledge to Vivasvan right at the beginning of the lifetime of this manu. So he does a calculation that a manu lives for about 305,300,000 years. And we, of that period of 305 million years, about 120,400,000 have passed already. How he arrives at that is that in a lifetime of a manu, there are approximately 72 cycles of the four yugas. One day of Brahma is 1,000 cycles. There are 14 manus in one day of Brahma. So if you divide 1,000 by 14, you get, it's not an exact figure, but you get, it's about 72. So there are 72 cycles of the four yugas in the lifetime of one manu. Krishna appears in the 28th cycle of, actually of the seventh of the manus. Anyway, in the lifetime of this manu, he appears in the 28th cycle. So if you multiply, one cycle of four yugas is what? 4,320,000 years. You multiply 4,320,000 by 28, and you get about 120,400,000. I don't know if you're able to follow that, but that is the idea. 28, we're now in the 28th cycle. So 28 times 4,320,000 is about 120,400,000. So assuming that Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to Vivasvan at the beginning of the lifetime of this Manu, it would mean it was 120,400,000 years ago. But then the knowledge became lost. And now, in verse 3, Krishna explains that I'm going to explain it to you, Arjuna. Why? Bhaktosi me sikha cheti. Because you're my devotee and my friend. Of course, there were many Brahmins and great saintly rishis and different types of saintly persons like that present on the planet. Even Vyasadeva himself was present. But Krishna chose Arjuna, and Arjuna's a kshatriya, he's not even a Brahmin. But why? Bhaktosi me sikha cheti. Because you're my devotee and my friend. Therefore you are able to understand this because of this quality of consciousness, that pure devotional quality of Arjuna's consciousness. He'll be able to grasp all these things. So parampara, you know, to establish the parampara as such is a very important thing. Very important. We shouldn't underestimate. In a sense, it's even more important than killing the demons and doing that sort of thing. In fact, when Krishna says dharma samsthapanataya, to re-establish the principles of religion, practically the most important thing that Krishna does in order to re-establish the principles of religion is to re-establish the parampara. Very important. So, in the second subsection, verses 4 to 6, Arjuna asks a fairly obvious question, at least for someone who doesn't really understand Krishna's position, that you're saying that you spoke this knowledge to Vivasvan, and we take that to be 120 million years ago, but how's that possible? Because Vivasvan, because you've only been on the planet at that time, the Battle of Kurukshetra, Krishna had been on the planet something like 89 years. Battle of Kurukshetra took place 36 years before Krishna left. And Krishna stayed on the planet 125 years. So if you take 36 away from 125, you get 89. So you're only 89. And this sun god, you know, talking about 100 million years ago that you're meant to have spoken this knowledge to them. So how's that possible? So then Krishna goes on to explain that he's now starting to establish his position as the Supreme Lord. You and I have appeared many times, Arjuna. It's verse 5. We've appeared many times together. I can remember all of them. You can't remember any of them. You can't even remember any of them. But I can remember all of them. So I'm different from you. I'm different from you. And what is the difference? The difference is that Arjuna, or should we say at least, the conditioned soul changes body. Prabhupada explains in these purports that we lose our memory of what happened even earlier in this lifetime, what to speak of in, say, our previous lifetime. We lose our recollection because we lose our body. The memory somehow or other goes with the body. Every 7 years, our body, all the cells in our body are replaced, apparently. So this is one fundamental reason why we're so prone to forget. Because somehow the memory is connected with your gross body. And when you lose the gross body, the memory tends to go with it. People who don't believe in reincarnation, one reason they often give for not believing in it is they say that I can't remember a last lifetime. So seeing I can't remember it, I don't feel that it exists. I don't feel that I had a last lifetime to be remembered. But we can then ask them that Do you remember being in your mother's womb? And I doubt whether any of them will remember being in their mother's womb. And then you can ask them that, do you therefore think that you were not in your mother's womb? And obviously we were in our mother's womb, but we can't remember. So just because you can't remember your last lifetime or any other previous lifetimes doesn't mean that there was no last lifetime to be remembered. But the thing is that as we change our bodies, then our memory is lost. But Prabhupada did explain in one letter that when you become completely purified and your consciousness is free from the influence of the mode of ignorance, then you can remember all your previous lifetimes, if you want to. Might not be a very nice thing to remember. Prabhupada once suggested that one reason that Krishna doesn't allow us to remember so many previous lifetimes is that it might be too shocking to see that there I was as an animal, living in horrible conditions, suffering, all sorts of terrible conditions. So we're not able to remember. But Krishna, he remembers his previous appearances, and of course later on Krishna explains that he knows all living beings, he knows the past of every living being, he even knows the future of every living being. So his consciousness is not at all limited, it's unlimited, because he's the Supreme Lord. So then in verse 6 Krishna explains why it is that I'm different from you. Because I have the spiritual body which never deteriorates. Therefore I can remember everything. Therefore I can act independently of the modes of material nature. I can appear and disappear at will. I'm never forced to appear. I'm never forced to disappear. Completely transcendental. So this verse here, verse 6, is really the first very clear statement that Krishna makes to just completely put himself in a different category altogether. Others, like the verse before, it shows a distinction between Krishna and us, but it doesn't necessarily indicate that Krishna is God. It indicates that he's not in ignorance like us. But here he says, Bhutanam Ishvaro Pisan, that I am the Lord of all the living beings. Then in verses 7 and 8, Krishna explains why he appears. These are like popularly understood reasons why Krishna appears: to kill the demons, re-establish religion, protect the devotees, like that. But in one lecture, I'll just read a little bit from that lecture. It's printed in Teachings of Queen Kunti. Srila Prabhupada gives like a deeper reason why Krishna appears. So Srila Prabhupada says, now the Lord comes to deliver the devotees. Paritranaya sadhuna. The question may arise that the Lord comes to deliver the devotee, but the Lord is already delivered. No, but the devotee is already delivered. Because the devotee is fully engaged in devotional service under the shelter of Krishna, the devotee is already delivered. So, the question may arise that the Lord comes to deliver the devotee, but the devotee is already delivered. The answer to this contradiction is that a sadhu, a devotee, does not require deliverance. But, because he's very much anxious to see the Supreme Lord face to face, Krishna comes not to deliver him from the clutches of matter, from which he's already been delivered, but to satisfy his inner desire. Just as the devotee wants to satisfy the Lord in all respects, the Lord even more wants to satisfy the devotee. Such are the exchanges of loving affairs between the Lord and his devotee. So this is a very sweet way, very nice way of understanding this extraordinary phenomenon of the appearance of the Lord within this material world. He doesn't really have to come to deliver the devotees, because the devotees are already delivered. He doesn't really have to come to kill the demons, because the material energy will kill them anyway sooner or later, or some other demon will come and kill them, or some demigod or someone. He even doesn't so much need to come to establish principles of religion, because his devotees, they can also do that, like Srila Prabhupada established the principles of religion all over the world. So why does Krishna come? He comes because his devotees want him to come. And Krishna feels that, oh, my devotees want me to come, so I must come. I must come and reveal myself and perform my pastimes and in this way enliven my devotees, satisfy their desires. So ultimately that is really why Krishna appears. Krishna can't be forced to appear just because there's some political circumstances or something like that. But when his devotees want, then he can't stop himself from appearing. Then in verses 9 and 10, Krishna explains how beneficial, how important it is to understand about who he is, what his position is, what our relationship with him is, what it really means when he appears within this world. Janma karma chame divya, that his janma and his karma, they are divyam. They're transcendental, divine. They're not like ours at all. In fact, they're so divine that if you simply understand that fact clearly, that'll have such an effect on you that it'll bring you to the divine platform. So just consider how divine Krishna's appearance is. You just understand that clearly, and it'll elevate you to the spiritual platform, and you'll go to Krishna's eternal abode. Verse 10 is interesting in that Krishna refers to three categories of people: those who are attached, those who are afraid, and those who are angry. And he says that you have to become free from the influence of these three things. And people who have become free from these three things, they've actually achieved mat bhava, bhava, the level of bhava, or love of God. So attachment, the class of person who are being referred to by the term attachment, they're the gross materialists. They're simply attached to enjoying material life. Those who are afraid, they are the impersonalists. They're afraid of personal relationships. They've had so many personal relationships in this material world, and they've suffered. So now they think, no more personality. If I don't have a personality, then I won't suffer. Very good. So this is impersonalism. And then angry. That refers to people like the Buddhists. They become so frustrated with material existence generally that they want to commit spiritual suicide. So therefore they take up some philosophy like Buddhism, which teaches that there is nothing, that you don't exist. And because even in impersonalism, you still exist. You may not exist as an individual, but you still exist as part of Brahman. But those who have become attracted to the Buddhist type of philosophy, nihilist type of what's called shunyavad, zero knowledge, nothing exists, they become so fried that they're not even satisfied with the idea of liberation and merging into the Brahman. They just want everything to cease to exist altogether. So Krishna's saying, you have to become free from these three types of attitudes. They're impediments. And then if you fully absorb yourself in me, and if you develop transcendental knowledge about me, then you can develop love for me. And so many people have done that in the past. So you can see how Krishna is really putting himself forward now. That to understand me is very important, and to surrender to me is very, very important. Now, section B, verses 11 to 15. It's applying transcendental knowledge to activity, to some extent, sort of jumping around a bit here and there. Krishna really is explaining in these verses how he is related to everything, including material activity like karmakandiya activity. And that if you understand his relationship, even with karmakandiya, then you can become elevated and you can eventually become liberated. So verse 11, of course, it's a very well-known verse. It's in our list here. He's saying, as people surrender to me, I reward them accordingly. And everyone is following my path. So what does this mean? Everyone is following Krishna's path. Does that mean the karmis? It appears the karmis are following their own paths, doing whatever they feel will benefit them materially. But Krishna is saying that everyone follows my path. So, the purport Prabhupada explains that it's quite easy to understand how those who are interested in either Bhagavan, Paramatma, or Brahman realization, how they are following Krishna's path. Because these three features of the Absolute, they're just different features of Krishna. So even if you're trying to realize Brahman, that Brahman is just a feature of Krishna. So even though it's indirect, but still ultimately, you're approaching Krishna. So Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan, it's all path to Krishna. But what about just those people who are interested in sense gratification or mystic powers, these types of goals which are not spiritual? So the thing is that Krishna, through the laws of karma, he's already established that if you work in a certain way, any way, you can choose any way, and you work in that way. But Krishna has already established what result you'll get. There's no material activity that you can perform which is not covered by the laws of karma, for which there is no reaction. Even if you do some really obscure activity, then there's already a karmic result worked out for that sort of activity. So, whatever you do, Krishna's already set out that path. It'll lead to a certain goal or certain karmic reaction. Like if you eat meat, it's already established that if you eat meat of a particular animal, you get a specific result. That's already established by Krishna. So in a sense, that person, even though it appears they're following their own path, but actually they're following a path which has been chalked out by Krishna, and which reaches a certain goal which has been established by Krishna. So in this sense, even people who are materialistic or after mystic powers, they're following paths which have been laid out by Krishna. In other words, there's nothing new to do in this material world. You can't come up with something new. It's all been done before. And whatever result is meant to be achieved through doing that is already been established. So don't worry. So in this way, everyone is following Krishna's path. And that even applies, we see in verse 12, it even applies to demigod worship. Krishna doesn't say it in as many words, but here he's just talking about demigod worship people. demigod worship, which is referred to in verse 12, that is a part of this process of Varnashram, which Krishna is talking about in verse 13, which has been established by him. So then, in 14 and 15, Krishna is explaining that he is beyond this process of Varnashram. He's beyond the process of demigod worship. He's beyond the process of Karmakanda. And that if you simply understand this fact, that he is transcendental, then you also become transcendental. In verse 15, he says that again, just like he said in verse 10, that many people achieved love for him through understanding his appearance and activities. So again here in verse 15, he says that in the past, many great souls have acted with this understanding that Krishna is not implicated by any karma or any reactions to any activities. He's transcendental to the whole system of Varnashram. And simply by having this understanding also, they became liberated. And he's recommending to Arjuna that you should do the same thing. So these are two reasons then, or two things we should try to understand Krishna's recommending here. The transcendental nature of his appearance and activities, and the transcendental nature, or the transcendental nature of his appearance and the transcendental nature of his activities, that he isn't affected by karma. So if we understand his position in these regards, then we also become transcendental. Then in the next section, section C, verses 16 to 24, this is a little complicated. Krishna gives a rather elaborate description of what is the difference between three types of activities, or three qualities of activity. Now, you're going to get a question on this in your test, so you should make note of this. Krishna, of course, says it's difficult to understand. Even the intelligent people are bewildered in determining what is action and what is inaction. That's verse 16. Then verse 17, he gives the three categories. The intricacies of action are very hard to understand. So you should know properly what is karma, action, what is vikarma, forbidden action, and what is inaction, akarma. Now I'm sure you're all going to be great transcendental philosophers once you've been through all this. Karma means materialistic activity according to the Vedas. Following the instructions of the Vedas. That is karma. Make a note of this. Karma means activity, action as recommended in the Vedas. Material action as recommended in the Vedas. Vikarma means materialistic activity which is forbidden in the Vedas. Which is not recommended in the Vedas. And akarma means activity which is not activity. Rather interesting idea. Activity which is not activity. Inaction. Inaction, literally. But Krishna is going to explain in verse 18 that it really means activity which is not on the material platform. So these are three categories, or three qualities of activity. Proper materialistic activity, according to the Vedas. Improper materialistic activity, according to the Vedas. And activity which doesn't fall within the scope of material existence. So materially, it's considered inactivity. And now for a real
tongue twister or mind twister. Krishna speaks verse 18. One who sees inaction in action, and action in inaction, is intelligent among men. Well, I think you'd probably have to be quite intelligent to follow that, because it doesn't seem to make sense. In fact, it clearly seems to not make any sense at all. Sounds like some of this, the word jugglery you get from the impersonalists. Like John Lennon, I don't know if some of you are a little older would remember. I am you and you are me and we are all together. But actually, I am me and you are you. And we may be together, but we haven't merged. But people like this. Oh, sounds very nice. I am you, you are me, we're all together. Sounds very wise, very profound. But actually, it's not true. Like they say, service to man is service to God. But actually, that's not true. Service to man is service to man, and service to God is service to God. A very simple point, but people have such a hard time understanding it. And they think, oh yes, sounds very good. Service to man is service to God. Very profound. So one who can see inaction in action, and action in inaction, is intelligent. Well, so let us just try to explain that a little bit. Krishna says, not only is that the person who understands this point intelligent, but he actually becomes transcendental. It's quite an important point. So, inaction, inaction. That means like a devotee. Devotee is very busy serving Krishna in so many ways. But that activity is spiritual. So it's not karma. There's no reaction. It's not going on the material platform. So, from the material point of view, it's inaction. The devotee may be doing so many things, but from the material point of view, the devotee is doing nothing. It's inaction. So if you can see inaction within the activities of a devotee, you can understand it in that way. That means you're intelligent. That means you've got a transcendental type of perception. And then what about action in inaction? That means that the person is doing nothing, but actually they are doing something. So what this is referring to is a person who's trying to follow like an impersonal type of process. They're trying to stop acting. But they can't stop acting. Even if they seem to be not acting, they are acting. Like you may have heard of the Jains. The strict Jains, they wear like a surgical mask over their mouth and nose so they don't breathe in any little bacterias. And as they walk in the street, they have a little brush and they brush the path in front of their feet so they don't step on any bugs or anything. So it seems like inaction. Or a person is sitting down meditating. He's not doing anything. He's simply sitting down 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So it appears to be inaction. But we should understand that it isn't inaction. That he is acting. Like, take the person who's sitting down doing nothing. So, what about eating? If he doesn't eat, then of course he won't get any karma for killing animals or killing vegetables or whatever. So it may appear to be inaction. But if he doesn't eat, he ends up killing this body. This one. His own body. So it is action. He is killing this body. He may not be killing the bodies of the vegetables and the animals, but he's killing this body. So it is action. And he's breathing, and as he breathes, he kills little bacterias and other little things like that. And even the Jain walking along trying to sweep the street, he can't sweep away every single little entity. It's just not possible. So, it appears that they're inactive materially, but they're not. they're active. So a devotee is intelligent, and a devotee has a transcendental quality to his or her consciousness, because they can see that what appears to be action, the activities of a devotee, is actually inaction from the material point of view. And what appears to be inaction, if a conditioned soul tries to stop acting, but actually they are acting. So he sees action within inaction. So as we said, it's all a little mind-boggling, but still, important point. So then 19, 20, 21, going on to about 24, Krishna again describes karma yoga, nishkam karma yoga. It's basically the same sort of description we've come across in the later part of chapter 2 and throughout chapter 3. I won't read through all of it. It's summed up. Anyway. Well, 24 sums up like the goal of it all. Basically, the idea is no desire for sense gratification, working in so many ways, but because he or she is completely detached, they advance towards liberation. And then in 24, Krishna says, a person who's fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness, Brahma, on the Brahman platform, is sure to attain the spiritual contribution because of his full contribution to spiritual activities, in which the consummation is absolute and that which is offered is of the same spiritual nature. So Krishna, earlier in this chapter, he explained about his own position and how we should understand his position and how we should work in that understanding. So here we should understand that he is referring in these verses, say 20 to 24 or 21 to 24, that Krishna is talking about performing karma yoga, but for his satisfaction. And then you'll come to the spiritual platform. As he says, mameti punar janma na. You won't take another birth, but mameti, you'll come to me. Now, 25 to 32, it's a description of all different types of Vedic activities which a person may perform. Of course, Krishna's recommended karma yoga. But here he's referring to a number of activities which they're all recommended in the Vedas. It's not that they're just concocted activities. So if you perform these activities in the right way, then they may help you. Now, he's not really presenting them as an alternative to karma yoga. It's more like he's just presenting that they exist, and that they are bona fide, and they can help you. And even in certain elements of them, we can learn something. But mainly it's just a whole variety of Vedic activities. In 25, he refers to demigod worship. And then sacrifice performed for Brahman realization. 26, he's talking about different ashrams, Brahmachari ashram, and Grihastha Ashram. 27, he's talking about Patanjali Yoga, one of the Vedic systems of yoga, controlling the mind and senses through certain yogic practices. 28, he's talking about renunciation, sacrificing your possessions, austerity, Ashtanga Yoga, studying the Vedas. 29, he's talking about pranayama. Anyway, basically he's talking about different types of sacrifices or different types of bona fide Vedic activities which a person can perform if they want. And if they do those activities in the right way, then it can help them spiritually. Of course, he's really recommended, he's already recommended Karma Yoga. But he's just presenting that here are these activities. So if a person performs these activities in knowledge, he says in verse 33, the sacrifice performed in knowledge is better than just, you know, a sacrifice of material possessions without knowledge. Because all bona fide sacrifices should culminate in knowledge. If you perform these different types of activities which have been described in knowledge, transcendental knowledge, knowledge of Krishna ultimately, then they can help you become liberated. But if you don't perform them in transcendental knowledge of Krishna, then they won't necessarily help you so much. So now how do we get this transcendental knowledge? What do you do? Do you just walk into a bookstore and look on the bookshelf and see what book looks interesting to you and then buy it and then just decide to follow it? No, it's not quite that simple. This brings us into the last section, section E, which is a summary of transcendental knowledge. So verse 34, the first verse of this section, is very important. Hopefully you all know this verse. You get knowledge by approaching a spiritual master. It's interesting to note that Krishna does not say that if you want to get knowledge, buy a copy of Bhagavad Gita and read it. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that we're against buying Bhagavad Gita or reading Bhagavad Gita. But the thing is, even if you have Bhagavad Gita, but you don't have the direction of a spiritual master, then it won't really help you that much. Actually, you may become confused. In fact, Prabhupada made the point that before he presented his Bhagavad Gita with his purports in English, there were many Bhagavad Gitas in English. Actually, there were something like 700 translations of Bhagavad Gita in English. But Prabhupada made the point that not one of these translations had produced one devotee of Krishna. But when Prabhupada presented his Bhagavad Gita, as it is, then millions of people became devotees. So just see, this is the potency of Bhagavad Gita, as it is, in which the commentary is not just my idea or your idea or some idea that appeals to me, but it's simply a clarification. Simply clarifying what Krishna is saying as it is to help us, just to make it easier for us to grasp what Krishna is saying. So you have to approach a spiritual master. Otherwise, you won't really grasp. It'll probably go over your head or something like that. And what is this transcendental knowledge that you can learn from such a bona fide spiritual master? That's described in verse 35. At least the basic principle of transcendental knowledge is described in verse 35. Krishna says that by this knowledge, you'll see that all living beings are but part of the Supreme, or in other words, that they are mine. In the Sanskrit, he says, Draksyas yatman yato mayi. Krishna's making it very clear that he is that supreme absolute truth. All living entities, everything is part and parcel of Krishna. Or as Jiva Goswami says in one book of his, Krishna is identifying himself with two words. One is supreme, the other is me. These two words are synonymous in the case of Krishna. Supreme and me. Same thing. Me and the supreme is the same thing in Krishna's case. So that is like the essence of this transcendental knowledge, essential transcendental knowledge, that everything is related with Krishna. Then Krishna glorifies this knowledge, verses 36, 37, and 38, and 39 even, but particularly 36, 37, and 38. What to speak of not needing to be a big scholar or some big expert in the Vedas or anything like that? What to speak of not being some sort of Vedic authority? Even if you're the most sinful of all sinners, which is, you know, quite a qualification to have. I don't think any of us could claim to have that qualification. But even if you are the most sinful of all sinners, if you become situated in the boat of this transcendental knowledge about Krishna, then you can cross the ocean of misery. One devotee once said to Srila Prabhupada, trying to express a mood of humility, that, "Oh, Srila Prabhupada, I'm so fallen. I'm sure I'm the most fallen. There's no one more fallen than me." Trying to appear very humble. And Prabhupada said, "Actually, you are not the most anything. So we're certainly not the most qualified, that goes without saying. We're definitely very unqualified. But we can't even claim to be the most fallen. We're just sort of like ordinary, run-of-the-mill conditioned souls." Yeah, if Prabhupada said, "Yes, that's very nice, you are the most fallen, very good," then the devotee probably would have got proud and said, "Yes, just see, I'm the most fallen." Prabhupada appreciated it. But we're not. We're not the most anything. You know, the most sinful of all sinners, that means one person. There's probably one person in this universe, I don't know who he is, but he is actually the most sinful person in the whole universe. He's probably in hell somewhere. But even him, if he becomes situated in the boat of transcendental knowledge, he can cross over the ocean of misery. Just see how wonderful this transcendental knowledge is. So then Krishna goes on to glorify verses 37 and 38. It burns up all the reactions to your previous material activities. There's nothing so sublime and pure as this knowledge. It's the mature fruit of all mysticism, or in other words, of all spiritual practices. And one who comes to the level of yoga samsiddha, becoming perfect in yoga. What yoga? Karma yoga or devotional service. He can realize this transcendental knowledge. Well, in 40, Krishna again gives a warning. Like we mentioned, benediction is there and then a warning or a curse is there. So the benediction is that if you follow this knowledge, you'll achieve the supreme goal. The warning or the curse is that if you don't, you'll fall down and you won't be happy. So at the end of this chapter, Krishna is recommending to Arjuna, you act in this yoga, devotional service. And whatever your doubts are, then through this transcendental knowledge, Krishna conscious knowledge, you just eliminate your doubts and become nicely situated on the spiritual platform. We got time for one question, perhaps, Dr. Yogtesh. That's why we don't have transcendental love for Krishna. But even though we're attached and, you know, in Maya in so many ways, but this, once you become situated in the boat of transcendental knowledge, then gradually you can cross over this ocean of misery and get free of your attachments, your fear and your anger. I don't think we can take any more questions, I'm afraid. Otherwise they're going to get angry with us. Did everyone mark themselves present? Everyone who's here? Oh, you didn't? Okay, so read chapter 5 and start revising for the test all these different things, including... If you haven't noted down all these verses, then please do it right away before it's too late. I'll just repeat. We're going to want you to learn any three of these verses, any three as you like, for our test, which is coming up on Monday. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.